Now, Walter has set this talk up very well, except he didn't tell you that you're part of an experiment. This is the first time I've ever given a PowerPoint presentation. So I do have transparencies in the seat back there in case everything fails. Well, as Walter said, this is a real group effort. I'm going to talk about experiments on solitary wave collisions, similar cast of characters, the names you've already heard. There is one new name here, Ming Yi, who gets her name on there because she was a high school student who came in and did unbelievable work, including getting the highest score in an honors course on differential equations while she was in high school. So Ming did a lot to get us started on this topic during working in the summertime. I'm going to look at the two types of collisions that Walter just mentioned. Terminology, I'm used to calling them head-on collisions and following collisions, lack of symmetry there. I will be talking about experiments, but in conjunction with those experiments, there are some mathematical models for the head-on collisions. I will look at just linear superposition of KdV solitons. Ming did that. Doug Wright is going to talk about higher order coupled KdV equations. And Walter's already mentioned the numerical solution of Euler's equations. That's for the head-on collision. For the following collision, I'll look at the two-soliton solution of the KdV equation and also numerical solutions of Euler's equations. The experiments, this is a very old topic. It seems very simple. One-dimensional colliding solitary waves. It turned out it's probably the most challenging experimental thing we have tried to do over many, many years. And the reason for that is our goal is to get high-resolution spatial data at a fixed time. Okay. It's been tried before, in fact, usually cinematically, by photographing the surface or imaging the surface in some way. But the difference, the disparity in length scales, height versus width, in these long waves make that very qualitative. And we want really high-resolution spatial data. The key to doing that is repeatable experiments. I have to be able to repeat the same experiment over and over and over. How closely can you do that? And that's the challenge that we encountered. It involved all the equipment and things that we do in the lab, the wave channel, the wave maker, instrumentation carriage, wave gauges, pressure gauge, data acquisition system, control system, fluid domain, and special procedures needed to do this. We start out with the wave channel. This is a picture of the wave channel. It's glass-walled. Its total length is 13 meters, but we only use 10 meters for this study. Okay. The channel is 25 centimeters wide, and in all experiments, the water depth is 5 centimeters. Okay. The wave maker is kind of special. It is absolutely state-of-the-art wave maker. It's a linear motor. It's a motor that produces linear motion directly. We have a resolution of position to 20,000 counts per centimeter, zero backlash, only can be done by linear motors. We also have a Teflon paddle that has been machined to fit the precise walls of the tank so that there is no leakage around the paddle that we're dealing with. Let me just show you a brief. Here's a short movie showing the tank. Here's the tank. This is a wave gauge that sits above the water. It's not in the water. It's above the water, 2.5 centimeters. There are four of them sitting on this instrumentation carriage. This is the linear motor here, and this is the Teflon paddle, and you'll see it generate a small solitary wave and then a large solitary wave. That will come back up in the following wave experiments. So the things you need to know just to know the strengths and the weaknesses of the data you'll be looking at and why things happen. The instrumentation carriage. It sits on the tank on stainless steel rails. Its position is computer controlled over the 13 meters of the tank width, programmable control position, pushed by a linear belt drive that moves the carriage back and forth, supporting four gauges 40 centimeters apart. And these gauges themselves are non-intrusive. That was very important. They don't penetrate the water. Capacitance type, very high resolution, better than 0.04 millimeters in resolving heights. 40 centimeters apart. The thing that's important is that they're absolutely linear, repeatable calibrations. These gauges give you the same results every day. Okay? That's pretty much important for doing the repeatable part. The sensing element itself actually spans across the tank width for 12 centimeters. So we're averaging the wave height across the tank. It's a one-dimensional measurement. Also a key to being able to do repeatable experiments was a pressure gauge. A pressure gauge was installed in the bottom of the tank, 7 meters from the wave maker. It also provides a very linear output, and it will measure up to 10 centimeters of water head. Okay? So we're measuring pressure. We use the pressure gauge for two things. One is depth control. These waves are propagating a long time on 5 centimeters. It's got to be 5 pretty close or else the wave speeds change. And we use the pressure gauge. 0.02 volts change on water level and the pressure gauge corresponded to 0.3 millimeter change in depth, which meant I had to go over to the tank and add 1 liter of water in a tank that's 10 meters long, 5 centimeters deep. So we're watching the water level very carefully in the experiments. The data acquisition and control system is very complicated. It involves 4 computers and 4 operating systems, all working together. Unix-based server, then we have a hard real-time computer that takes in signals from pressure gauges and wave gauges, digitizes them simultaneously exactly with 16-bit accuracy, and writes it to hard disk all in real time at over 3,000 hertz. Sampling rate. In addition, the most important thing, though, is the control system. The control system is for motors, the motors that move the wave maker, the motor that moves the carriage, the motors that calibrate the wave gauges. All of that is controlled. All of this is synchronized together so that everything is happening through TTL signals that are being communicated and measured by different systems. General procedure, how are we going to get high-resolution spatial data? Okay, you position the carriage where you want it. You run an experiment, and when you do that, we have 4 gauges on the instrument carriage. You'll get 4 time series at the positions of those 4 gauges. Now, you move the carriage 1 centimeter and do the same experiment. Quote, the same experiment. Okay? You will get 4 more time series that are displaced 1 centimeter. Do this 38 more times, you will end up with 160 time series. Spanning 1.6 meters, 1 centimeter apart, of data that can now be interrogated at any time to give you the spatial profile. So we're getting spatial data by repeating the experiment. High resolution amplitudes at 1 centimeter intervals, X distance under the carriage. Of course, this works only if the experiments are exactly repeatable at all positions X and all times T, and that's not true, okay? To give you an idea of the small differences that we're looking at, if you allow the difference in arrival times of the two experiments to be 0.01 seconds different, that would correspond to a difference in position of the waves of 1 centimeter. So in the two experiments, I would have 2 waves that are not, they're 1 centimeter apart. That's the resolution of measuring things. That is a big mistake. It will show up very dramatically in the results. Where do you get small differences? First one, the one you cannot ignore, latency in electromechanical servo systems. Latency means that I'll tell something to do, mechanical or electrical device to do something. I now have to wait till it does it. I'm out of the loop until it does it, okay? So I can't control anything to that level. And the servo update period on the motor is 0.8 milliseconds. Okay, so that sets an 0.008 of a second. The experiments can easily be off. Water depth, I mentioned that already. I think we handle that. Water surface contamination, we went to a lot of trouble to show that during the time that these experiments are occurring, that is not a factor. We make that true. One effect I cannot ignore is residual boundary layers. When these waves propagate down the tank, they leave a wake. And I'm going now bouncing waves off of walls and sending them back to collide so they propagate through the wake of their own wake. In the following collision case, they propagate through the wake of the wave in front. So And then there's always pilot error, and there was a lot of that. I don't think it's any of that in what you're seeing, but you're doing deterministic real-time programming, meaning you're making mechanical and electrical devices respond at exactly when you want them to in a computer program, and that's always tricky. Wave generation, how do we have this programmable wave maker? To decide how to move the wave maker, we just adopted the velocity, horizontal velocity field of a KdV soliton. So U is the velocity field underneath the KdV soliton. It's in terms of the wave height, A naught, which, for example, 2 centimeters. Water depth, 5 centimeters. The linear speed here, squared of GH, is 70 centimeters per second. And what we then do is set the position of the plate, X of P, the time velocity of the plate equal to U, but U as a function of the position of the plate. So I have an implicit equation that has to be solved. What it does, though, is account for the fact that the wave propagates away during generation and the paddle moves. If you don't do that, if you stay at the KdV level and just set dxdp equal to u, you get quite a different result. Here is x of the position of the wave maker as a function of time to generate a 2 centimeter high wave. This would be the linear approach, the solid curve here, which would have the paddle moving almost 8 centimeters. The nonlinear approach gives you the dashed line, and that's what we used to generate fairly clean waves. Okay, here is a experimental result, the first one I'm going to show you. Here is the 160 centimeter window underneath the instrument carriage, and I'm looking at amplitude here, and this is data. Okay, I've gone in and interrogated the data set for a time at which there are no waves. Okay, and when you're looking at these amplitudes, this is 1 centimeter, so each little tick mark here is a millimeter in wave height. So it works. So here comes the wave underneath the carriage going by, and some waves, trailing waves. Let me do it again. Oop. Okay, so that's the solitary wave we're generating experimentally. Okay. And actually, these dots here are almost a half a millimeter in height. So, and you see we have a nice clean wave. This is halfway down the tank, by the way. So the wave has had a chance to adapt its shape. But there is a little trailing stuff behind. Okay, now to the head-on collisions. I want to collide two waves head-on. How do I do that now? First, I will fix the carriage position in the center of the tank. It's fixed. It just sits there. I generate one solitary wave, the one you just saw, actually, with 2 centimeters of height. It propagates 10 meters down the tank, hits the end wall, and bounces back. Okay. And while it's bouncing back, or 10.8 seconds later, I generate a second solitary wave with an amplitude of 1.25 centimeters, and these two waves now collide in the center of the tank, and I measure them. Then I wait 12 minutes, I move the carriage 1 centimeter, and I repeat that experiment, continuing 40 times, and that gives me the 160 centimeters of data. This is just a page of raw data from it. I'll say it from this is one experiment. During one experiment, I measure this is time versus voltage from a transducer at the 4 gauges on the tank, on the instrument carriage. I also measure pressure, which is fixed in the tank. Never changes its position between experiments, so it should always be the same signal. And in this particular case, we measured the wave heights right above the pressure gauge, but I'm not using that data.
Joe,
here. Yeah.
You know the reflected wave is the same as the progressive wave going the other way. I mean, that complexity changes at the wall.
Oh, yes. In fact, something happens at the wall.
Yeah.
You'll see that. Well, the wall. We looked earlier at Maxworthy's data. Maxworthy started out trying to model the head-on collision of two equally amplitude waves by hitting a wall and mounting it back. Those are not the same experiments. They're not the same experiments. And I only had, at that time, one wave maker, one linear motor. So I couldn't generate two waves. One at one end of the tank and one at the other. I had to bounce, to get a head-on collision, I had to bounce it off the wall.
You have a little relaxation time that it bounces off the wall and propagates for a while.
That's right. It readjusts. Pardon? It looks, well, you'll see it here in just a moment, how cleanly it looks. It's also damping, remember?
It's interesting if it's burning by itself, the reflection from the wall.
Pardon?
It's interesting if it's burning by itself.
Yes, yes, but it's different than colliding two head-on solitons, like two solitary waves. Here's an example of what you wanted. Remember, I have 40 experiments now, and there's differences between them, however small their differences. So I want to shift all, I'm allowed one free shift. Okay. I have a pressure gauge measurement that is the same in every experiment, theoretically. So now I will use that pressure gauge and correlate all the 40 time series and shift them so they line up the pressure gauge measurement. That takes out latency, other small effects. Turned out that works very well in the following sense. How much do you have to shift? Well, I did 20 experiments in one day. The most I had to shift those to make them line up was 0.0154 seconds. I then did the next 20 experiments the next day, and just by setting down and setting up again, I ended up having to shift 0.058 seconds. I mean, so clearly things were a little more different the second day. But then I have a pressure gauge that sees waves going past it. If I use the passage of the first wave that was generated to do the shift, I end up capturing the wave coming down the tank. Here is an experimental picture of the wave coming in this direction and the wave coming in this direction. And what I do if I use that wave for my correlation or shifting, I get this wave cleanly, but I don't get the reflected wave cleanly. That was a real bother for us. We couldn't figure out what was going on, thought the wall was really doing things badly. But then, suppose I now use, instead of the first wave that passes the wave gauge, pressure gauge, I use the reflected wave as to shift all my data. If I do that, I get the reflected wave beautifully, and I don't get the incident wave. Okay? Something is happening during this process of propagating to the wall, reflecting, and coming back that introduces an arbitrary shift in the data that is different, okay? And I can't get rid of it. We ended up using this one because this wave was so clean, and it turns out that this is the right running wave, this is the left running wave, weren't so bad. Okay, so here is another movie of experimental data of the collision process itself. And that took about 5 seconds, I guess, for it to happen. I can get the. But you see raggedness in the wave. The wave that I didn't resolve well stayed not resolved well all the way through the collision. Okay, and I could switch that around. I can get the other one, but I can't get both at the same time. No, not here. No, everything was quite smooth here. See, you go high enough. These waves have an A over H of about 0.2, okay, coming together. So these are small waves. I could, in the sense that Walter was talking about, and my limit was the pressure. It was the wave gauge. It sets above the water surface. It's a capacitor. If the water ever touches it, the experiment is over. And so I had to limit the height of the waves. That's the only drawback to these gauges. This is an XT diagram that's sort of orthogonal to what Walter showed you. He had X on the bottom and time here. I have space here. Here's my 160 centimeters. So here's a wave coming in. Here's another wave coming in. They collide, and then they go out. I haven't tried drawing this. I shouldn't be doing this. There is a phase shift. I have other evidence of that. Okay, here's a better view of what's going on. This is the Euler calculation of Philippe Guin, sitting back there, for the collision. Here's the initial data, the experimental data, and what Philippe did here was fit two KdV solitons and linearly superpose them as initial data. So the first wave is 1.05 centimeters high. The second wave is 1.2. That's the reflected wave here. very fast. We don't have that much comparison, so let me do it a frame at a time here. That's the initial data. Now they're coming together. Again, the solid curve here, Euler code is solid line. There's a linear superposition of two KdV solitary waves here that we keep that allows us to see phase shifts very clearly. It's a dashed line. Coming together, coming together, coming together, coming together. And now you notice that there's a little abrupt discontinuity here. That's due to the fact that I'm not resolving that left wave as well as I should be. The wave I'm resolving well, I resolve well all the way into the collision and out. Amplitudes are increasing. Unfortunately, we didn't happen to analyze the frame at maximum amplitude. Now it's coming down. Watch down, though, the differences. At that point, linear superposition up until the run-up point was doing really well. But coming down, you begin to see this is KD, this is linear superposition giving you this big dip, whereas we never see that in the experiment, and Euler captures that beautifully. Now you're seeing the two waves separate. Okay, and now I hope you can see this dashed line is linear superposition, which says no phase shifts. Okay, and you can see Euler is already showing a slight phase shift, and the data is a little less than Euler. Prediction. And that's still true. And that's the last set of data here. So here is no phase shift, Euler prediction of phase shift, experimental phase shift.
What do you mean exactly by Euler?
It's the numerical computations of Euler's equations that Walter was describing earlier. Exactly the same ones. Yeah. Okay, interesting, the nonlinear sum. If you linearly sum the two heights, you get 2.27 centimeters. We measured 2.66 centimeters. Euler predicts 2.76 centimeters. Okay. So that's the difference. That's the run-up that's in addition to the linear sum. Following collisions, let me just show you a movie. So here's a movie of the following collision experiment. The instrument carriage is near the wave maker. We generate the two waves you saw before, and those two waves come underneath the wave carriage, and then we follow them down the tank. You're looking at a wave gauge here, setting above the water. Once the wave gets underneath the carriage takes off and follows the waves down the tank, measuring them in a moving frame of reference. Okay. The carriage motion is all controlled and programmed. So here is a set of data. And the first set of, here is the initial data that I'm taking. But here's a small wave I've generated, the larger wave behind it. They are now just come entering into my measurement window. And what I have fit here with a solid line is a two-soliton solution of the KdV equation. So this movie will just be the two-soliton solution. And now the carriage went down and stopped, and the waves kept propagating at the end out from underneath the carriage. And I can do that one more time. Knowing exactly where the carriage is at, you saw a little shifting in the phase of the waves with the theory. That's experimental, I'm afraid. Okay, Philippe also looked at this initial data and used the Euler code. Here's the initial data again. The solid line is the two-soliton solution that I had fit to the data. But Philippe noticed that if you just linearly sum two KdV solitary waves, you got a much better fit of the initial data. Okay. And that's the way I generated them, using a linear sum. Okay, I did not use the two-soliton solution. And here is the Euler solution. Oh, boy. And we don't have as much data, so let me go through it frame by frame. The initial data, a little time later, a little time later. Again, this the difference in phase here, I feel sure is my problem and not the leap's. Okay. A little time later. And that was the last set of data I have right now. There will be more, but not today. So here are the last slide. This is the last time we had the Euler data. So here is the larger wave overtaking the smaller wave. The solid line is Euler's prediction based on the initial data with a linear sum of 2 kDV solitons. The dashed line is the 2 soliton solution of kDV. The only thing I'll point out here is that both Euler and kDV are inviscid. So if I had no Euler calculation here, I would say, here's the predicted inviscid amplitude, here's the measured. The difference is probably viscosity. That's the rug that we sweep a lot of things underneath. But look at the Euler prediction. It's all predicting only about this much stamping, if you want to wrap that up. Okay, I better stop there. Thank you. I'll stop.